Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, good morning. It's March 15th, 2009. Gentlemen, that makes this the Ides of March. Beware the Ides of March. You know, Julius Caesar met his end within about 1 kilometer of the Solder Smoke Studios, right across the river, right across the Tiber, was the area, the place, the exact place where he was stabbed is subject to some dispute, but it's known that it was near, in the area of Pompey's Theater, which is right across the river. Pompey's Theater was so big that it now encompasses a huge area of Rome along the Tiber. And there's a couple different places where you'll see people claim that this is where Julius Caesar was assassinated. But, well, it's right over there. In any case, it's it's within about a half a mile of where I'm sitting. And that is one of the things that makes Rome, wow, was such an interesting place. Things like that are all around you. We were last weekend down at the beach. We went on a beach trip last Sunday to the closest beach to Rome is a place called Ostia. And there's some really nice beaches there, and even in early March there were a lot of people on the beach on a Sunday afternoon. We had a nice picnic there, threw the football around, flew the model airplane. A nice day. A little bit further inland from that beach is Ostia Antica, or Old Ostia, or Ancient Ostia. And that's where the old Roman port was, where the Tiber met the sea. And Billy is getting set to go on a... Well, he just came back from a trip to Ostia with his class. In fourth grade here, they cover ancient Rome. And that's what they're doing. So he got a... He got a kick out of that. He had a good time, and it's really a beautiful sight. Later in the month, they're going to go and do Pompeii, the city that was destroyed by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. So a lot of history around beware the Ides of March. All right, shifting to ham radio. I want to say a few things to kind of celebrate the Knights of QRSS. Think about it, guys. Those of us who are into QRSS, we're making it through the sunspot minimum with a minimum of RF power. Making it through the sunspot minimum on 50 milliwatts, 100 milliwatts, some cases 5 milliwatts, and still getting signal reports and communicating. Johan, ON5EX, who I think is really one of the key leaders of the QRSS MEPT movement, reports that there are now 248 knights of the QRSS roundtable. The only thing it takes to become one of these, to join this esteemed company, is to sign up for the Yahoo Knights of QRSS mailing list. And then you too could be a knight of the QRSS. But anyway, there's about 248 guys on the list. It's an interesting group. It's a very useful way of exchanging information on what's happening with the MEPT QRSS beacons. I noted on the blog, you'll see on the blog a couple of articles about some people who are QRSS heroes, or I'm now starting to call them wizards. I decided that since we have the knights, we should have some wizards. And One of the guys who I've nominated for this this kind of honor, I guess, is Alberto, I2 PhD. I mentioned him in the last show. I might have gotten the call sign wrong, but Alberto is the guy who has produced and made available to the ham radio community a good portion of the software that lies behind QRSS and the MEPT beacons, especially the grabbers, exclusively the grabbers, the receive systems. Alberto's a very interesting guy, interesting ham radio background. And I got to say, one of the things I wanted to mention was that a while back, when I was looking at Argo, which is his program, I was going through the README file, I was really struck by how he had included a lot of kind of art and beauty, even in the README file of a piece of software. You don't find that a lot. And Alberto had managed to include mention in the README file of Jason and the Argonauts, and how they went off in a small boat in search of the Golden Fleece. And he said that the Golden Fleece for us is the small signal, the signal out there buried in the noise. That's what we're seeking with QRSS programs. So that's where the name Argo for the software comes from. And Alberto included in the README file a little video of the boat of the Argonauts sailing off, and I have that proudly displayed in the Solder Smoke slideshow. So three cheers for Alberto and the Argonauts. Another guy that I've nominated as a wizard of the nights is G3ZJO Eddie, and you'll see a picture of his one of his many QRSS beacons on the Blogspot page. In this case, Eddie has used a 2 555 timer chips to generate the letter G, and the G is transmitted by a third chip, a very simple little transmitter. I have a nice picture that I grabbed from one of Eddie's videos, and that's up on the Blogspot page. Check that out. I mentioned in the last show that I could tell when there's been a power outage in my house, because at work, if I look at the Johann's grabber page, and if I see a flat line, I know that the circuit breaker has blown sometime during the morning, and so that's a bit of telemetry, guys. Actually, telemetry was a term used by Jim AL7RV, who wrote in and said, "Great, you have a telemetry system, a simple telemetry system." I thought that was giving it a little bit too much credit, but we're going to stick with it. A couple guys wrote in and with suggestions on how I could come up with backup power supplies to keep the K1EL Keir going. But I said, yeah, but how will I know if there have been a power outage? So we're going to keep the telemetry system. I had another example of the telemetry system last week when the antenna, the little wire that goes out the window that goes up to the roof that is my antenna. I guess it was blowing back and forth in the wind one too many times, and it broke. And I noticed a dramatic reduction in my signal strength on ON5EX's grabber up in Belgium. That's what happens when you have no antenna. Although I do think I saw a trace of it in there, so even with the little bit that was sticking out the window, I still might have been making the trip to Belgium. But anyway, another example of my telemetry system in action. I was alerted to this, and I repaired the antenna. Last week we were talking about the need for kind of mechanical keyers so we can keep the transistor count to one with our beacons. Our friend in Australia, Alan VK2ZAY, immediately wrote in with noting that there was a precedent for this kind of thing, and it comes from the Steven Spielberg movie E.T. from about 1982. When you think about it, and Alan was the kind of guy who would think about this thing, he was the only one, but he's right. E.T., when he built that little communication device to get in touch with his people so they could come and get him you know, ET phone home and all that. Think about it. He might have been using a QRSS MEPT beacon. He used like kind of a say and spell kind of device and an old phonograph, and he managed to get a circular saw blade in there. We have a picture of the whole thing up on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. Take a look. It's a blast from the past, and I think it was real interesting and that Alan drew the connection between that and QRSS. I think it was the saw blade that got him. Certainly the use of the phonograph, the old phonograph, that might be a good kind of motor drive for a QRSS beacon. Guys wrote in and talked about you could etch the desired CW sequence onto a little circular PC board and drive that with either a clock motor or maybe a slowed down record player. A lot of ways to do it. I might take a trip over to the Trastevere flea market this morning and see if I could pick up an old clock that might be suitable for this. I mentioned that it would be great fun if we did it with a wind-up clock, so it could be all kind of renewable energy. And then somebody wrote in and I said, well, you get extra credit if you could figure out how to power the actual transmitter from the power of the wind-up, from the same wind-up mechanism that drives the clock. A couple guys wrote in and talked about how they some poor ham out in Omaha had part of his station, or at least part of his antenna, blown up by the bomb squad, who came into the house and thought that they had found some sort of terrorist operation underway. I was thinking about this when I was kind of at the same time thinking about the wind-up ET phone home kind of MEPT beacon. Man, if the cops come in and find that, it's going to get blown up for sure, but I guess we're just going to have to live dangerously. QRSS, MEPT News, possibility of a couple of new grabbers, a fellow down in VK6, and I don't have his call sign in front of me, I'm sorry, he steps up to the plate and says that he might be able to fill the void that is going to be left when VK6DI goes back east in Australia. So good to hear that we might have a new VK6 grabber in the makings. And from the Middle East, from Dubai, Ron Sparks, Alpha Alpha 5, Radio Sierra, reports that he still can't transmit because the local authorities haven't given him a license. He has a friend there who does have a license, who may be able to put an MEPT beacon on the air from his home station. And Ron says that he's going to be working on a receive station in his own house so that he might be able to give us an MEPT beacon from Dubai, which, of course, would be very interesting. Lawrence KL1X, who has been operating the China grabber, is temporarily QRT from China, but is now going to be in Costa Rica for a bit and might be able to put some sort of grabber on the internet from Costa Rica. Thanks for that, Lawrence. I might have mentioned this last time, but I've been active on Echolink. I've been there several mornings in the last couple weeks, and I had some really great conversations. I've been talking to Jerry NR5A about his work on a new MEPT beacon. I had a talk with M0NDE of the Dover Construction Club. Nigel has some great stories about a wonderful kind of club that they have formed there in Dover in the UK, and we hope to get Nigel on with us here real soon, and so he can tell us in an interview about what's going on with that club and about his life on both sides of the English Channel. And this week, this is a special feature this week, we have an interview with Jeff, KO7M. Jeff is the fellow with the Piper Club airplane and the MFJ Cub QRP rig. We put him up on the blog a few days back, and we'll have an interview with him later today. Couple other notes on QRSS. This is just me thinking about this kind of unusual mode. I took a look. Do you know how long it takes me to send just my call sign on QRSS, using QRSS3. That's a three second per dot CW system. 6 minutes. Yep. At least 6 minutes to get that call sign out. Now, mine is a bit of a mouthful, that I0-N2CQR. But still, 6 minutes for the call sign. Shows you how slow we're going. Also, here's another question for you guys. This is a kind of a technical issue, and I'm sure it'll stir up a little bit of controversy. I'm now using frequency shift keying. And when it goes key down, my frequency drops by 5 hertz. This is my upside down FSK. Am I using FM? Is this a form of frequency modulation? I leave that to the experts. Let me know, guys, what you think. Kind of had the telescope out this week. Not looking at anything terribly interesting. I just took it out into the courtyard to show some of the kids here in the neighborhood and my kids the moon. It was great. It was fun. I want to do some more of this. My wife tells me that that using the telescope puts me in a tranquil mood. I guess astronomy is good for the soul. So I'm gonna do some more of that. Speaking of astronomy, the other morning, this is the morning I fixed my antenna. I was on EchoLink talking to NR5A. We were talking about transmitters and antennas and signals, and I started feeling bad that my antenna was not radiating. So I figured out a way I could fix the little wire from the window without actually having to go up on the roof. But before I did, I took a look up to see if I could see Saturn. Saturn is up in the morning. Couldn't see Saturn. The Janiculum Hill of Rome was blocking my view. But as I was looking up, a satellite went overhead, right out of the window. Looking out the window from light-polluted, bright sky Rome, I saw a satellite very distinctly going overhead at just about 5:45 in the morning. So I did what you do in that situation. I went back to the computer, fired up a wonderful website called Heavens Above. The link is on the blog, and quickly identified one or two candidate satellites. I think I was looking at either an old Russian rocket or a large panel that had been sent up for some radar or laser experiments back in the 70s. Interesting. Speaking of satellites, I have an article, short article on those intrepid British radio amateurs and students of the Kettering Group, who very early in the space program made some big headlines by making some big discoveries about satellite launches, and they did some great satellite monitoring work from the UK. Always an inspiration. I found a picture of them and some links to articles about their work and investigations. I think you guys will find it interesting. Check it out. It's on the blog. Let's see. What else? Oh, another thing good for the soul. I've actually been making ham radio on the air RF contacts. You know, the internet's great. MEPTs are fun. Beacons are great. But there is no substitute. And I think Wes was the one who reminded me of this. There's no substitute for the good old-fashioned two-way on-the-air contact. So I've been firing up the HW8, mostly in the morning, mostly on 40 meters, but sometimes on 80. And I've been having some real nice QSOs. I've been trying to have at least one real QSO, CW QSO, each morning. I've been working into to France and Germany. I can sometimes hear the states booming in. W8GEG was booming in on 40 meters real early one morning this week. So there is a possibility for transatlantic contact here on 40. I've made one USA contact on 40 CW using the HW8, but that was a while back. Finally, my other project here involves a computer. This usually, when I say that, the story usually has a sad ending, because I find it very frustrating to work on computers. I far prefer working on real simple analog QRP circuitry with Manhattan style construction. There troubleshooting is a lot easier. It's not mysterious black boxes and black boxes, inside black boxes, and all that. But, you know, I got an email from Kevin, ZL3KE. This was part of our discussion of transistor counts and how many we could have one transistor on the transmit side, and you need 40 to 100 million on the receive side when you're running QRSS. Kevin wrote in and said that he's been trying to make use of simple, old, clunky computers as part of a kind of a QRSS, a keep life simple ethos that he has there in New Zealand. I said, you know, of course, that's all admirable, but I pointed out that he's still in the tens of millions in terms of transistor count, even with the old clunky computers. And he agreed, but he and I also agreed that there is something charming about using these old defunct machines that nobody wants. And that's what got me into my current project, which is reviving my old Toshiba Satellite Pro 400CS computer. I use this thing for a long time. I like this computer. I know it's an old piece of junk. I know I should get rid of it and buy something new. I know that I should probably buy another one of the web notebooks like Billy has and get going in the modern age. But you know how it is. When you have the knack, you don't like to throw electronic equipment away. And you don't like it when there's a bit of electronic equipment around that's not working. Well, that's my problem here now. So I'm stuck on this project. I got to get this thing going. The hard disk died probably 2 or 3 years ago. You guys might have remembered that when I talked about that. I put a replacement hard disk in, one of these little tiny laptop hard disks. I popped it in there. And I didn't know how to partition it. I didn't know how to format it. So it's just been sitting there. The whole thing's just been sitting there kind of taunting me. Anyway, Kevin, ZL3KE, got me going on this project. I am making some progress. I've got a bootable DOS disk so that I can get to the A prompt now. And even without the hard disk, I can actually run some programs just from the RAM. I can run TrackSat, satellite tracking programs and such. After we finish recording this morning, I'm going to go back to it. Kevin has given me hope that I might be able to get it going, and my plan is to turn it into a Linux machine. That's the other thing that's coming here. Turn it into a Linux machine and make it fully functional. Man, I could make this thing useful. All kinds of uses I could put this computer to. So anyway, that's what I'm working on here. All right, without further ado, let's bring in today's guest. Jeff, KO7M, is a real interesting guy. You can see pictures of his two cubs, the MFJ cub and the Piper cub, up on the Blogspot page. Check it out. We had a real nice chat. One thing we didn't talk about, which we should have, was his first QSO with the MFJ cub. But don't worry, I have the email that he sent describing it. That's up on the Blogspot page. Read it. You can really just feel the excitement, man. Build that rig. Get it on the air, and your very first QSO, you cross the mighty Pacific and talk to Japan. Fine business, Jeff. All right, here we go, KO7M.
N2CQR, N2CQR, Kilo Oscar 7 Mike. Are you there, Bill?
Yeah, there you are. Very good. All right. And it looks like my solder smoke microphone is cooperating this morning. It's been a little bit intermittent, but good morning from Rome, Jeff. I got 40-meter CW from the HW8 playing in the background. U.S. stations coming through here. It's 0432 hours UTC, 5:30 in the morning here, and I can hear W8GEG pounding. Very nice CW into the 40-meter band. Call him. He didn't hear me. but I have worked across the pond here on 40. So what's up? What's happening at KO7M this morning? KO7M, N2CQR.
Yeah, Bill, N2CQR, KO7M. Oh, I'm just sitting here playing with LT Spice, believe it or not. And I, too, have the little MFJ Cub playing in the background on low end of 40 meters. I'm listening to no one in particular, just kind of got it playing in the background to add to the ambiance, as it were. But yeah, I've been playing with LTSpice a little bit, trying to get used to that application a little bit. And I'm having all kinds of fun with it. It's pretty interesting. Pretty interesting stuff. Kind of a learning tool for me as well, because I'm really a neophyte at solid-state design. So I'm having fun being able to try things out without burning my fingers. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, LTSpice, yep. Well, you know, we're big fans of LTSpice. Mike and I we had many, many adventures in virtual circuitry. Wes always cautions that that we have to remember that there's real limitations on the simulation and that the real experiments are on the workbench. And he's right, of course. But it's a great tool. I love it. I've been, I've been talking to my friend Jim, AL7RV, and I think I mentioned he sent me an email saying, basically cussing me out for suggesting that he start up with LTSpice because he's now spending inordinate amounts of time in virtual circuitry land. And he said, you know, he came up with this great idea. I mentioned it on Solder Smoke, but I don't know if people caught on to this. But what a great idea. He wants to come up with a PIC-based program and have a little device maybe next to the keyboard or close to the monitor or something, and that he wants it set up so that every time he places a resistor or another component into the circuitry, his little device, maybe with a rosin solder pot actuated by the PIC program, emits a little puff of solder smoke. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what's next. Maybe you'll have to have something device that will periodically scorch your finger or something and have real realism. And I guess you'd have to throw something in there in the program to kind of randomly make circuits that should work not work. Anyway, yeah, I like LTSpice. It's you know, there's some good guides out there for getting started. Nick Kennedy, WA5BDU, has a really good one. One of the things with LTSpice is most of the users are not ham radio oriented folks. They're using it for other design purposes. And I really like Nick's guide because it lets you. It's really oriented towards the kind of use that we make of LTSpice. So check out Nick's guide. But I like it. I played with other versions of Spice beforehand, and I found them really kind of not user friendly. But LTSpice is as the Brits would say, it's the business. KO7M N2CQR.
Yeah, Bill, N2CQR KO7M. Yeah, I like the virtual solder smoke simulator there. That's a great idea. Of course, we'll have to include some software algorithms for cold solder joints and the like, you know, or a lifted trace algorithm, I think would be the next logical step, don't you think? Okay, on Nick Kennedy, I'll have to check out his guides or tutorials to see what he's got to say, because I've got a lot to learn, let me tell you, when it comes to solid-state design. I've been reading everything I can get my hands on and devouring solid-state design and experimental methods. I listened to a lot of your discussions with Mike about RF amplifier design. I had to laugh a lot of times at some of the experiences, and in particular, I was really amused by Mike's adventures in trying to get any RF power out of an IRF 510. You know, I've looked at just about every IRF 510 design that's on the net, because I have a few of those devices around here. And trying to model them in LTSpice, my experience is that that I'm designing attenuators more than I'm designing amplifiers. So I seem to be not able to get anything in the way of amplification out of an IRF510 design of any form in LT Spice. So I'm not sure what to make of that other than I've got a lot to learn. So taking designs that were supposedly proven designs and published on the net, and simple designs even, and just tried to replicate them and model them in Spice, and boy, I'm just not having any luck at all. So I could use some pointers on that. N2CQR KO7M.
KO7M. KO7M. I had you up there in Alaska for a second. I'm sorry. KO7M. N2CQR. Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people would say, aha, you see, it works in the real world, but it doesn't work in LT Spice. I don't know, maybe Spice has some quirk with the IRF 510, because guys do get RF out of it. I think it's especially good on 80 and 40, but I think as you get higher up, if you're looking at 20 meters or above, there might be problems there, and I think it's because of the capacitance between the terminals. So I think that's it. I vaguely recall something about that, but maybe 80, maybe 40. No, I think definitely 80, maybe 40. Above that, you might be pushing the envelope. So maybe give LT Spice a second chance at perhaps at lower frequencies. Somebody said it. I forget who said it because it was a great, way of expressing it. They said if you take LT Spice, add experimental methods in RF design and or solid state design for the radio amateur, together you've kind of got a BSEE in a can. I added a third element. I said you got to add QRPL or a similar technically oriented mailing list, because that group then will provide the mentorship and the place to get your questions asked. But you take those three elements, QRPL, LT Spice, and experimental methods in RF design, and you could teach yourself a lot of electronics. Now you're being modest there, Jeff. I know you have a double E background, so you're way ahead of most of us. But I think what this business about a BSEE in a can is especially true for those of us who come at it without that kind of background. Anyway, I like it a lot, but it's got to be combined with the books and the QRPL group. Hey, listen, I wanted to ask you about the airplane. I've been looking. We've got the picture of your airplane up on the Solder Smoke blog. And it was only supposed to be up there for one day, but it looked so good, I couldn't bear taking it down, so I left it up there for a second day to give everybody a chance to look at it. It's not like we're getting millions of visitors; we're getting hundreds of visitors, but it's a small, select, elite group, and I wanted them to have a chance to look at that beautiful Piper Cub for a little bit longer. Tell me about what's a typical trip like in the plane, and how do you combine it with ham radio? Do you actually take the MFJ Cub in the Piper Cub, and where do you go, and what kind of antennas, and have you had some interesting kind of remote QRP to the field operations combining airplane and QRP, KO7M into CQR?
Yeah, the airplane, my favorite subject. Oh, I love that airplane. It's about as much fun as you can have with your clothes on. And trips are anything but typical, I suppose. I spent just a little bit of background first. I got a private pilot's license first. And I preceded that event with probably about 60 hours in helicopters. So I originally learned to fly in helicopters, and then Then took about a 12-year hiatus on flying, and then started flying again right before 9/11. And I started flying in fixed-wing aircraft then, and got a private pilot's license, and immediately went from there to get an instrument rating, and then followed on with multi-engine training, commercial pilot, multi-engine commercial pilot, and added my my seaplane rating. A bunch of other stuff along the way, high-performance aircraft and tail-wheel aircraft and so forth. So anyway, so basically what all that amounts to is several years of just nothing but back-to-back training. And never really learned how to have any fun in an airplane, you know. So so my first adventure was to head across country, just point the nose at the horizon, and I flew across the country to the Oshkosh air show, and spent a month flying around the country in a rented airplane. 2 years later, to repeat all of that in my own airplane, my first aircraft, which was an American Champion Scout. So selling the Scout and buying the Cub, I then started sort of investigating the other end of the spectrum, like low and slow flying, inverted flying, flying in and out of grass strips and places where there is no runway, stuff like that. So being a lot of fun. But combining that with the ham radio side of things, I have a Yaesu FT817 and a G5RV wire antenna that I keep in the plane. But I've recently added an Aero beam antenna for satellite work as well. And so I use the FT817 and the Aero beam or the G5RV, and then I also use a little pocket PC program, some little software to locate satellites. And with that set up, I can work all kinds of stations from HF all the way to UHF. Looks like we're about to time out here, so I'm going to drop this for a minute. So I've done quite a bit of satellite work, usually Oscar 51, AO51, and then for the HF stuff, I'll take a length of line and toss it up in a tree and drag the G5RV up in the air, and usually I work CW right now all I can seem to get any contacts on are 80 and 40. The higher bands have been pretty dead for us around here, or at least for me. And when I bought this Cub, after kind of getting inspired by Solder Smoke to build something, I bought it specifically because it was the MFJ Cub, matching the name of my aircraft. So it has yet to make it into the airplane, but we're going to take it out this summer. We're going over to Idaho for some backcountry flying this summer. And I'm going to take the Cub with me and the G5RV and see if we can work a little CW from the backcountry in Idaho into CQR, KO7M.
Oh, KO7M into CQR. Well, I hate to use the word, but that is just so cool. It's kind of a technical term, you know, that's so cool. I hear the tech guys out there in Silicon Valley talking like that, but it really is. That's amazing, yeah. And you've got to get the Cub in the Cub. That could be kind of that would generate a lot of interest. And you might even want to let MFJ know that you're, you know, the Cub from the Cub at some remote lake out there in Idaho. Man, this is like you're in ham radio hero territory here, Jeff. This is great stuff. I always want to. I guess a lot of us are like this. There's a lot of kind of related technical interests and related technical hobbies, And when you talk to a lot of hams, you'll say, well, I was also interested, or I'm also interested in this, and then you'll get a lot of, me too, yeah, me too. And I went through a time when I was a kid where I was just addicted to airplanes. I used to wait, and I knew when the next issue of Flying Magazine would arrive at the DeForest Pharmacy in Congers, New York, and then I would get on the bike, and I'd be up there pretty much, you know, just moments after it hit the newsstand, and then the very patient pharmacist would let me stand there and practically read it and devour it right there, you know, in front of the magazine rack. And then I used to ride my bike over to the Ramapo Valley Airport in Rockland County, New York, which was a long bike ride, and I'd just sit there and watch the Cessnas and the Pipers fly. My father took us up to the Rhinebeck Aerodrome in upstate New York to watch the World War One planes, it's one of these things now, one of these days. I never got my license, I never did, but now I'm sitting here listening to you, and I'm getting the urge. So I may have afflicted you with QRP homebrewing and LT Spice, but I think you may have given me this morning a much more expensive addiction. but that's really cool. And the satellite thing, wow, I didn't realize that you were working satellites from remote locations with the airplane. I was talking, I've been talking on Echolink to Jerry, NR5A, who is, of course, our man in South Dakota. And also, he's been working with 87BP and KB0ADD on putting together stations for the same satellites, as many of the satellites that you mentioned. And so I think they'd be really interested in talking to you, airplane remote. I don't imagine you're working the satellites there while you're actually flying the plane. It would be kind of difficult to orient the antenna and avoid inverted flight with the Cub. But yeah, we better work them from the ground. But I played around with satellites quite a bit. I haven't done it for a long time. I was using the RS-10 and RS-12 satellites. Talked to the Mir space station when Norm Thagard was up there. Great fun. And occasionally, you know, it's one of these things. I get the satellite urge too, and I'll fire up something at least to listen. But I haven't been sending any signals through satellites in a long time. But wow, that the airplane operation, that is really neat. Now, you said something. I think you mentioned that you carry you mentioned the gear that you're carrying. And I thought it was really, really interesting that you could get on just about any band from remote locations with the plane. That sounds that is neat. But I guess these days, like you said, 80 and 40 would be the place to be. Let's see. Yeah, I took a look out. Speaking of other hobbies, I took a look out the window this morning to see if I could see Saturn. But unfortunately, Saturn is a little bit low right now, and I can't see Saturn because of the Janiculum Hill, not one of the seven ancient hills of Rome, because this was outside the gate. But the Janiculum, named for the god Janus, is pretty famous, and that's what was blocking my view of Saturn this morning. Somehow appropriate. KO7M and 2CQR.
Yeah, Bill, N2CQR, KO7M. Yeah, very good. Well, Bill, run, dude, run. If you get in the airplane urge, run. It's a terminal disease, let me tell you. Once you get bit, there's no turning back. I grew up not exactly next door, but a couple doors down from a gentleman when I was in grade school, who was rebuilding an old Stearman biplane in his garage. And I lived down there at his garage for about 7 years, it seems. He took a long time rebuilding this thing. When he got it, he had the tubular steel frame that of an aircraft that had been wrecked, and one about 6 foot section of one of the wings, and that's all he had. Everything else he constructed from scratch. And I was down there being a generally being a pest for most of my pre-teenage and teenage years. So so that was kind of where I got the plane bug at a young age. And then when he finished the plane and was ready to take it for its test flights and stuff, you have to put so many hours on it before you can take passengers. And he got all that done, and then he invited me to go for a ride. And I was all over that. But I had a father who was not all over that. So he nicked the whole idea, and it kind of pissed me off, and I kind of walked away from airplanes for many, many years. But once one of my own sons raised the interest by mentioning to me that he was looking at maybe going in the Air Force, I took him down to the airport and got him a demo flight, and that kind of got me back into flying again. So anyway, that's the story there. Fine on NR5A and the satellite work there. The gear, the FT817 is 160 through 440 rig, and I'm dying to try the Cub out when we go flying. So we'll get that on the agenda here real soon. maybe when I'm over in Idaho, I can set up a schedule or something with NR5A and see if we can work them via one of the Oscar satellites while I'm over there. I think that'd be a lot of fun. And fine on Saturn there, I've never really gotten into the astronomy side of things. Would be a logical extension, but you know, you kind of got to pick your poison, I guess, huh? N2 CQR KO7M.
Yeah, be careful. These things, these afflictions can hit you real fast. KO7M, N2 CQR. I remember talking about getting people interested in something. When I was in the Dominican Republic, I was getting really interested in satellites, and actually that was the satellite, the need for updated satellite Keplerian elements or information on where the satellite was going to be was what first got me into the internet. I was sitting down there in the Dominican Republic. This must have been 1992, 1993, and QST would occasionally publish kind of the schedules of when satellites were going to be overhead. There was a AO-41, which I think had a 2-meter downlink, and some other satellites like that. And so I would, you know, be at the right place in the right time based on the QST article, and I'd be able to hear the satellite, and wow, I got really all fired up. But then now I needed to know. I mean, I needed much more information. So AMSAT sent me this great program called Orbitz 2, and I fired that up. But of course, it's pretty useless if you don't have a good source of updated orbital information. So I needed to get that. So I that was what caused me to connect to the internet. And as a matter of fact, we had in those days we had to do it in a very, very expensive route. We had to make a long distance phone call to a CompuServe node in Miami. That was our internet connection. I ran up one heck of a phone bill. But I got the Keplerian elements, which is, of course, the important thing. on airplanes, oh, man, I am in danger here. I'm a subscriber to Air and Space Magazine, which is one of my favorite magazines. My mom renews the subscription for me because she knows I'm interested in this stuff. And I'm especially interested in the part of that magazine where they talk about rebuilding projects or reconstruction projects, because it's very knackish. You know, it's a workshop. It involves skill and craft and working on old gear that other people think of as junk. The Stearmans, oh man, the Stearmans are prominent in that world, of course. When I read the Air and Space, every once in a while they'll have an article about like these kind of airport towns. You know, I think there's one out on the eastern shore of Maryland, or in an island in Chesapeake Bay, where basically some airplane nuts have decided that it would be great to have their houses kind of, instead of being built around a golf course, built around an airstrip, and then they have instead of garages, they have little hangars out there. And I'm reading this thinking, wow, this is just brilliant. This is the place to be. This is the place that I want to live. Of course, my wife might have other thoughts about it, I suspect. The kids might not be all that crazy about it. Billy would be all right with it, but I don't know about Maria. They have, I think they have, you know how it is. They have other priorities, so... But that shows you how susceptible I am to this kind of addiction. If I find myself thinking, yeah, that's where I want to live. I've mentioned that, and you and I talked about this before, my only solo flight experience is under canopy, under very unpleasant circumstances. The Army makes anything that could be pleasant unpleasant, and they certainly did that with parachuting. I was talking to a guy at work yesterday about, got to talk about parachuting, and he had done some sport jumping, and he talked about how much fun it was and all this other stuff, and I said, yeah, when I did it, fun, it was interesting, but there wasn't a whole lot of fun in it. The Army manages to squeeze the fun out of things, but I've only soloed under a Dash 1 Bravo parachute. It was interesting. Let's see. What else? I was going to ask you about something else. Oh, yeah, the astronomy. I have a little 6-inch Dobsonian reflector here. Very simple telescope. But Saturn is one of my favorite targets because even from the murky, light-polluted skies of Rome, you can see very clearly the distinct rings of Saturn. One of the fun things to do is what they call sidewalk astronomy. I've done only very, very little of it here in Rome, but the idea is you take the telescope out onto the sidewalk someplace, and as passersby, come across the telescope, you give them a chance to take a look. We did this in London, and it really is kind of a mind-blowing experience for some of these folks who've never looked through a telescope. In London, I had people tell me that I was doing some sort of a trick. They thought I had some sort of a slide or a transparency in the telescope, and that they weren't really looking at Saturn, but they were. KO7M, N2CQR.
Oh, that's too fun, Bill. N2CQR, KO7M. Yeah, real fine on the... on the satellite work down in the Dominican Republic. Getting the CAPS way back then was a bit tricky. I'm familiar with the CompuServe bit and the GE network and others that kind of preceded a lot of the sort of ubiquitous internet dial-up access, let alone broadband access. There was a time when my company had one single 128 kb kilobit per second connection between the U.S. and all of Europe. And in Europe at that time, we were networking 5 remote offices. So it was pretty pathetic. As I recall, too, way back when, in the early Oscar days, there was an ARRL device that was available called the Oscar Locator, and I think it was a plastic device that would enable you to determine the Oscar location and when it would be within view of your place on the planet. I don't know if you remember those or not. Air and Space magazine is a great magazine. I have a fishing buddy friend who regularly gives me his discarded copies of Aviation Weekly, So I'm usually going through a pile of those every week and recycling them as they come through. It's pretty interesting. When it comes to air parks, yeah, they're great fun and really I think a great idea. I would love to live on an air park and love to have my aircraft right outside. But it's a bit of a strange culture living on an air park at times, and it can be quite restrictive. Years ago, when my wife and I first got married, I actually took her and we went and looked at a piece of property on an air park. This particular one had a had the unique characteristic of being on a private island. So in the San Juan Islands here in the Northwest, north of Seattle, there's an island called Blakely Island, and it's private. The only public part of it is the boat dock area, the marina, and then there's a little kind of a general store there on the marina, and that's the only public part of the air of the island. And they have their own runway there, and so it's kind of an interesting place. Looks like we got to drop it for timeout here again. Kind of an interesting place. The all the cars on the island were last licensed whenever they came on the island. They never licensed them again because all the roads are private, so nobody cares about paying taxes to support license tabs on vehicles and the like. So it's an interesting place, kind of self-sustaining, and their own recycling center and import business to bring goods onto the island for the residents and stuff. But it was a bit too much of a lifestyle change, I think, and so we kind of passed on it. We weren't quite ready for that dramatic a change in our lifestyle, so we moved on. Ended up buying a house on some acreage where we've got room for the dogs. Soloing under a canopy. Well, you're a better man than I, Bill. I'll fly it down to the ground unless the wings are falling off, and I'll stay with the plane if you don't mind. Unless there's no other choice, I'm not likely to step out the door. But to each their own, I guess. I like the idea of the sidewalk astronomy. I think that's a great way to meet people and to kind of stimulate interest in areas that might be outside of the average person's scope, at least initially. If nothing else, it's a great conversation starter. So I think that's just great. Keep that up. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing you're doing there. I think my only astronomy experience is lying on my back under the stars on a sleeping bag and kind of trying to figure out what's up there and recognize patterns, but that's about the size of it. As far as other projects around here, been trying to build a little test equipment because as I get into this a little bit, I seem to need things like the ability to measure power and stuff like that. So we've been putting together a little bit of test equipment. We're keeping it simple. eBay stuff, things like that, things I can build or things I can pick up for cheap. I managed to find an LCR digital meter on eBay for real cheap, and so I gathered that up real quick. So there's a few other things we need, you know, signal generator, counter, things like that. So someday I hope to own an oscilloscope, but right now I don't own one. N2CQR, KO7M.
Yeah, KO7M, N2CQR. Yeah, the sidewalk astronomy, it was actually kind of invented by a fellow named Dobson out in San Francisco. He had been a monk, I think a Buddhist monk, and then left that and started making... came up with a system to make really, really cheap, really good, and fairly powerful telescopes. They made them out of cardboard sonotubes, kind of shipping tubes. And he came across a huge stockpile of porthole glass, like glass that was going to be used for portholes on ships. So it was fairly thick, and they were able to use it as a real inexpensive bases. They could grind it to get the parabolic mirror shape and then put some coating on it. And it was really ingenious. And the Dobsonian, they call the telescope Dobsonian because it sits atop what's in essence kind of a lazy Susan that you'd have on the table. And so you don't have any real expensive or complicated mounting mechanism. It just sits there and you kind of spin it around. It usually floats on a bit of Teflon. And it's really easy to point and aim and very, very, portable. So I think I should get out there. Yeah, the sidewalk astronomy is fun. You do get to meet a lot of people. Some of whom, especially in an urban setting, might have some unusual ideas about astronomy and the universe. And, it requires some diplomacy. But we're going to give it a shot here. Talking about this, I've gotten to thinking about doing it some more of it here. We live in a very interesting and kind of bohemian neighborhood of Rome called Trastevere. And I think sidewalk astronomy would be a hit here. We've got a lot of a lot of artists, a lot of writers, some hippies. I think sidewalk astronomy would fit right in. So I'll have to report back to you on that, Jeff. On test gear, I need more test gear here too. I think we all do. I'm glad you got the LCR meter. I have mine from almost all digital electronics, and it's really I find it one of the indispensable tools. I use it all the time. My oscilloscope is pretty pathetic. It's a little ham egg, tiny little thing. I picked it up at the Kempton Park Hamfest or rally back in London. It only goes up to about 15 megahertz, but I can see things at higher frequencies. Of course, I'm not seeing the harmonics very well, but it's still useful to see at least what the fundamental frequency looks like. It's I use it all the time and like it a lot. It's got a very small footprint. My shack is tiny here in Rome, so size is an important consideration here when I'm buying test gear. I have an old signal generator. It's like a Heathkit SG-8. I think it's one among Heath's first creations. It's got tubes in it, but it still generates a pretty stable RF. And I've been talking on Solder Smoke about my frequency counter. Yeah, this the frequency counter. I talked about my very painful chip replacement project. I don't know if you caught that episode, but when you were talking about add-on software for LT Spice, it occurred to me that maybe we should have something in there that, at random, when you place an IC chip into the LT Spice circuitry, that LT Spice will every once in a while cause you to put it in upside down, and then solder in all 32 connections. That would certainly add an element of realism. I felt kind of foolish telling everybody that I had done that, but I was heartened when I got many, many, many emails with guys saying I did that too. So this is an improvement to LT Spice. Jeff, I've got to wrap it up here. It's got a couple things to do before I start getting the day going. We've got a couple of extra kids in the house here now. We've got a couple of children from friends here staying over. They go to school with our kids, and we're taking care of them here. So it slows down the morning routine a bit. It's fun, but it makes things go a bit slower. So I've got to start getting ready. But it's been great talking to you, and I hope we can do this again. Talk about airplanes and get that MFJ Cub in the Cub and LT Spice and all this. It's been great. Let's do it again real soon. KO7M and 2CQR.
Excellent. Okay, Bill. N2CQR, KO7M. Yeah, real good on all that. Yeah, your frequency counter experience, dude. Oh man, I just cringed. Just I could see it coming for 10 miles, and oh, I just was right there with you. I've done that so many times, and no, I didn't put in the socket. Oh no, man, what pain. Yeah, it cracked me up. But I wanted to ask you one last thing. We're gonna play Name That Sound. I remember you doing this on Solder Smoke, and I've got a sound for you I'd like you to hear. Here it is. So this irritating little sound is all over the low end of 40 meters. It tends to move up and down the band about 100 kilohertz or so. And sometimes it's absolutely wiping out everything on the band. And other times it's just this little click like you hear right now. So ever heard it before? What is it? N2CQR, KO7M.
No, I've never heard it. But we'll have to refer this to our worldwide panel of experts. Jeff, I'm sure somebody will know what that is. I don't hear it over here, but it may be just because my antenna is too poor that it's, it sounds quite strong, but I haven't heard it here. I don't know what it is. We'll have to figure this out. My first inclination was to blame the woodpecker, but I don't think the woodpecker quite sounded like that. But you never know. It might be some sort of, you're close to the coast. It might be some sort of over-the-horizon radar system, something like that. We'll see what the panel says. Hey, I wanted to tell you, too, before I go, I know that I'm an airplane nut because as I look around the shack, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I've got 6 model airplanes or flyable airplanes. And at least 1 model rocket here, so I'm well on my way to addiction. KO7M N2CQR.
Very good, Bill. Yeah, well, throw it out to the panel, and we'll see what they have to say. I'd love to know what that is. I remember the woodpecker, and that ain't it. I remember that growing up, but. Look forward to it. Hey, when you're in the States, I'll take you for a ride. That'll put you over the edge of nothingwell. So we'll let you go. I know you've got a busy day ahead of you. Thanks for the time with you. I appreciate the opportunity to sit here and visit on Equilink, and look forward to doing it again. We'll send it back to you for you to tie the ribbons on it. N2CQR, KO7M.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Jeff. We'll talk again real soon.
All right, excellent, Jeff. Thanks very much. All right, time is getting tight, but it wouldn't be Solder Smoke without time for
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
I love them.
Indeed, yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. Not too much mail this week, but we got a real nice message from Gene W3PM. He has another call sign GM4YRE. He told us that he'd been listening to Solder Smoke from the QE2 while on cruise. All right. And he sent along a schematic, actually a block diagram and some links to a rig that I find really interesting. It's a real simple homebrew transceiver for the Whisper system. Check it out. I have it up on the Blogspot page. I'm really tempted to build this thing. And as a matter of fact, Jim, AL7RV, writes in and said that after he saw my article on the Blogspot page, he is sending me a care package with parts for the W3PM Whisper machine. So stay tuned. You may be hearing whispers from the Eternal City. Very good. We talked about Alan's observations on ET's QRSS beacon. Jim, AB3CV. Is building a color burst gnat. A gnat. That's the new sensation in the minimalist world, and Jim is building one for the color burst frequency of 3.579 megahertz. Fine business, Jim. Jason, NT7S writes in and notes that in last week's mailbag, we had a bit of Tektronics and Serendipity. That's a mouthful, Tektronics Serendipity. There were at least two or three Tektronic employees mentioned in the last mailbag. We had W2AEW, W8NF, and I guess NT7S makes it three. Oh, no, the third. I know it wasn't a Tektronic employee, but other people from the Beaverton area were mentioned. Jason reports that we have a big following at Tektronix, and we have listeners involved in all stages of the design and construction of the same RF instruments. So a big Solder Smoke shout out to the guys at Tektronix. One of these days, I want to get one of your beautiful scopes. I have a need for a Tektronix scope here. One of these days. I mentioned KL7KE's thoughts on computers. Paul, M1CNK, has built a new QRSS beacon using an AMQRP DDS30 board, a pickaxe 8M for the keyer, a temperature control module, and a W8DIZ amp. For a whopping 150 milliwatts out, he fired it up and was very quickly captured by another of the Italian heroes of QRP and QRSS, I2NDT, Claudio's beacon up there in the north of Italy. Very, very useful. The first beacon that captured my signals, too, so thanks to Claudio for that. Finally, we have an email from Soren, OZ2DAK, and his thought is that we should power MEPT beacons with exercise bikes. Very good. Very interesting thoughts, Soren. Get going. Get pedaling. Come on. You're only up to 50 milliwatts. We need 60. Pedal faster. All right, guys. Enough of that. 7-3 from Rome.